Well, this evening we turn our attention to Pesach matters, and as we are wont to do, we'll begin by discussing matters of halacha and minhag as relate to Pesach, and then we'll move on to the more thematic items related to the Haggadah. And as we know, there's no shortage of Haggadahs and no lack of what to discuss, so we'll make our selections and our comments. So, to begin with a pre-Pesach matter, there is a pasuk that gives us a directive with regards to chametz, what to do with chametz, and that is in Shmos Perek Yud Beis, pasuk Tes Vav. And there, the Torah says, Tashbisu se'or mibatechem. Tashbisu se'or mibatechem. Which we would perhaps translate practically as remove or destroy chametz, or others might say cancel chametz. And importantly, although the pasuk says Ach bayom harishon tashbisu se'or, the Torah gives the time of this mitzvah as yom harishon, it is very clearly not to happen on the first day of Pesach, but rather on the day before Pesach. Rashi informs us, as indeed the Gemara does, the word rishon sometimes can mean the preceding day, and specifically, it is from midday of erev Pesach. That is the mitzvah of tashbisu. So that's our pasuk. Let's keep that there just for a moment and talk about two concepts that relate to dealing with chametz. One is biur chametz, biur with an ayin, the destruction of chametz. And the second is bittul chametz, the nullification of chametz. And the bittul is something that we do actually twice before Pesach, firstly, immediately after the Bedikas Chametz, and secondly, just at the time of the burning, that's when we declare it, that it should be like the dust of the earth, etc. That's Bittul Chametz. So once again, we have Biur Chametz, which is the physical destruction, and Bittul Chametz, which is more of an attitude of nullification. And the question that we need to consider for the next few moments is, how do these two concepts relate to one another? Biur and bittul, destruction and nullification. Do they go together? Are they both needed? If so, why and on what level? And more specifically, if we'd frame the question, after all, we opened the shir by quoting the pasuk, Tashbisu se'or mibatechem. The Torah says what you need to do with chametz is tashbisu. Which of these, destruction or nullification, is tashbisu? And which is other? So here we find major statements on the part of Rishonim. Rashi, not on the Chumash actually, on the Chumash Rashi does not comment one way or the other with regards to the meaning of the word tashbisu, but in his commentary to Maseches Psachim on Daft Dalet, Rashi says that the word, the meaning, or the mitzvah of tashbisu is to do bittul. That nullification, where we say that the chametz is like the dust of the earth, that is the fulfillment of the Torah's mitzvah of tashbisu. To nullify it, of course, we note, the Torah didn't say destroy it. The Torah said, well, give it a rest. Tashbisu, it's a much more elusive term, perhaps. And that is why Rashi understands that the fulfillment of tashbisu, the way that you deal with your chametz, is to nullify it, and then you're good to go. And notably, the Rambam concurs with Rashi. The Rambam in Hilchos Chametz u'Matzah, in the beginning of the second perek, he begins by saying, Mitzvah sase min haTorah lahashbis haChametz. It's a positive mitzvah to do tashbisu on your chametz. And then he asked, Umahi hashbasa zu? What is tashbisu? Ha'amura b'Torah, says Rambam, he sheyevatel ha'chometz belibo, to nullify it in your heart. That is the mitzvah of teshbisu. V'yachshevoso ka'afar, you should relate to it like dust, and it's like it's nothing for you. Shekol chometz b'rishuso harehu ka'afar. All the chometz in his possession, it's like dust. And if you've done that, you have acquitted yourself as far as this mitzvah is concerned. And also worth noting is that the Rashi and the Rambam have been pre-concurred with by Unkelus, it seems, because Unkelus' translation of the word Teshbisu is Tevatlun. And therefore Unkelus actually came, of course, first, 1,000 years before Rashi and Rambam. And he is already telling us that Teshbisu is Tevatlun. Now, there should be no misapprehension. Even if we nullify the Chometz in fulfillment of the Torah's mitzvah of Teshbisu, we still destroy it, we still get rid of it, no question about it, but that is possibly an added measure, a rabbinic measure, to prevent against eating it. Because if you're hungry, chametz tastes the same, whether or not you declared it like dust. And therefore, and we're so used to having chametz around the house, there's all the reasons why there's no question at all that we need to actually search and destroy and remove the chametz. The question is, which is the primary mitzvah of the Torah of Teshbisu, and what is a secondary measure? This, in summary, is the opinion of Rashi. The mitzvah of Teshbisu is fulfilled through bittul. Physical destruction is just to get it out the way to avoid mishap of eating, etc. Now, Tosfos take strong exception to this position of Rashi for two reasons. Let's take them one by one. Arishon Rishon. Firstly, says Tosfos, you may know, if you've learned the first, the second chapter of Maseches Psachim, there is a dispute among the rabbis of the Mishnah how you're meant to get rid of chametz. Rabbi Yehuda famously says it needs to be burnt, specifically. Ein bir chametz ela sreifa. It has to be burnt. The Chachamim give you more leeway, you can crumble it, scatter it in the wind, throw it in the sea. There's other ways to get rid of it. But those are the opinions of the rabbis versus Rabbi Yehuda. And specifically, or significantly, Rabbi Yehuda's opinion that it needs to be burnt is learnt from Psukim. He derives it from Nosar, actually, from leftover korban food, which needs to be burnt, and he makes that equation. The rabbanon dispute the equation, but they are debating on the currency of Torah-level obligations. Sounds like the physical destruction of chametz is a Torah mitzvah. It's a Torah obligation, not a secondary or rabbinic obligation. That's very difficult to avoid. You have rabbis of the Mishnah effectively telling you that the Torah mitzvah of Teshbisu is to physically destroy the chametz, either through burning or maybe through other means, but it's physical destruction. It's not bittul. So here, in defense of Rashi, the Ramban and others say, there's no question that Rashi will concur that if you physically destroy the chametz, you have fulfilled the mitzvah of Teshbisu. He doesn't mean to say that it's fulfilled through bittul, through nullification, and not through actually destroying. But rather, Rashi's point is that since the Torah has given you a broader term, so it's given you more latitude in terms of how to fulfill this mitzvah. It could be through physical destruction, no question about it. And if you do, there may be opinions as to how it should be done, burning specifically, or perhaps otherwise. But the broader term of Teshbisu also allows for bittul. So that is the first question of Tosfos. Again, how can Rashi say Teshbisu is bittul if rabbis of the Mishnah seem to say that it's a Torah mitzvah to physically destroy it? And for Rashi, both are involved in the mitzvah. But then Tosfos raises a second question, quite a different type of question. And briefly, it's as follows. The mitzvah of Tashbisu, as we prefaced, starts halfway through the 14th, meaning at Chatzos, at halachic midday of Erev Pesach. That's when Tashbisu kicks in. That is a point, says Tosfos, where bittul is no longer possible. Why is bittul no longer possible at that time? Because at that time, chametz is forbidden, both for consumption and for benefit, which basically removes it from a person's control. The Gemara says once it's reached that stage where you can't eat it and you can't get benefit from it, you can't do anything with it. You have no say in it, and you can't even declare it as null and void. Bittul needs to be done before that point. And now, says Tosfos, will someone please explain to me how the mitzvah only starts at Chatzos, at which point it can't be done? By definition, it has to be done beforehand. That's a very difficult challenge. And that's why Tosfos say Tashbisu must mean physical destruction, which can be done when the mitzvah begins at Chatzos. But an explanation of Rashi's position, the Minchas Chinuch in Mitzvah Tes has a very interesting thing to say. We assume that this mitzvah of Tashbisu, which we're kind of keeping it in a box for the time being, but this mitzvah of Tashbisu, it's like most mitzvahs, it's a mitzvah to do something. But it could be that Rashi understands that the mitzvah is not to do something, but rather to enter a certain state. Now, that sounds a bit abstract. What does that mean? Let's give an example of this second type of mitzvah. Resting from malacha on Shabbos, which is a positive mitzvah of the Torah. It's one of the 248 mitzvahs. And the Torah says, tishbos, rest. How do you rest? What do you do? Nothing. So how do you fulfill the mitzvah? By doing nothing. But how is that called the fulfillment of a mitzvah? Because you are ensuring that you are in a state of non-malacha. And that is the fulfillment of the mitzvah. It's what you could call a passive mitzvah. Because it requires ensuring that you're in a certain state. Says the Minchas Chinuch, Rashi clearly understands Tashbisu, and it's very interesting that Tashbisu sounds a lot like Tishbos. It could be that it's similar. The goal of the mitzvah is not to do something at that point at Chatzos, but rather when Chatzos comes to be in a chametzless state, just like when Shabbos comes to be in a malachaless state. Now, what do you need to do to reach that state? You'll need to take measures beforehand, such as bittul, which can only be done beforehand. So you have an amazing prizing apart of what you do in order, how do you perform the mitzvah? That's called bittul before Chatzos. And how do you fulfill the mitzvah? By having done bittul at Chatzos, by having no chametz at Chatzos. So that is the suggestion of Minchas Chinuch. For Rashi, it is a passive mitzvah which happens at Chatzos to be in a state of no chometz. But back to Tosfos as things come to a head here. Because we've only seen Rashi's position so far. What is bittul? It is the fulfillment of Tashbisu according to Rashi. That's how you deal with your chometz. That's the mitzvah. Tosfos say no. Tosfos say, as we've seen quite clearly, their position is the only thing you can do with your chametz is to destroy it. So what is bittul? And we all do it twice. What bittul is, says Tosfos, is not the mitzvah of Tashbisu, but rather it is declaring, removing your ownership from the chametz. You only violate bal yiroi and bal yimotze, the averus of own chametz. If you remove it from your possession, hefker. If you declare it hefker, then you thereby will not be in violation of owning chametz because it's not yours. That is what bittul is according to Tosfos. In other words, if we could sum up these two positions in one sentence, The difference between them is that according to Rashi, nullifying the chametz, bittul, is the fulfillment of a mitzvah, known as tashbisu. According to Tosfos, nullifying the chametz is not the fulfillment of a mitzvah, it's the avoidance of an avera. You just want to get it out of your possession so that you don't own it when the critical time comes. Now, two, I would say, major implications, or ramifications more correctly, of the opinion of Tosfos are, and it's very interesting to note historically how things happened. The nusach, the text with which we nullify the chametz, which we know how it begins, kochamir vechamia, everything that I have, the ikir b'rishusi, it's in my possession, we say, lebotel, let it be null, and what? So the early, one could say, at the risk of oversimplifying, but the ancient or early versions of Bittel said, concluded, lebotel ka'afra da'ara, let it be null like the dust of the earth. Now that actually reflects Rashi's opinion. Because if you just say it should be nullified, it should be null like the dust of the earth, I mean, that's you are diminishing it, but you're not relinquishing ownership of it. And that is why other Rishonim, endorsed by certain Acharonim, the Bach, say that according to Tosfos, it's not enough to say that it should be null like the dust of the earth. You need to say that it's Hefker. And that actually, I believe, is now the widespread text of the Bittel, is like Tosfos. Because it concludes, Lebotel, let it be null, Veleve Hefker, Ka'afra Da'ara, and let it be ownerless like the dust of the earth. The inclusion of the word Hefker explicitly in the Nusach of the Bittel, which I believe is now said in that way by everyone, although I wouldn't presume to have seen everyone, but I checked in the art scroll, so that's a good place to start. And it wasn't even, the word Hefker isn't even in brackets, which means it is a full-fledged member of the text. And that reflects without a doubt the opinion of Tosfos. According to Tosfos, Bittel is Hefker, so you need to say that it's Hefker, which we all do. Perhaps not realizing until this evening the implications of saying that it's Hefker, but we're basically taking a side in the Tosfos-Rashi debate. The second ramification of Tosfos' position that Bittel is getting rid of it from your ownership, Hefker, is as follows. In the morning, when we burn the chametz, so we say Bittel again. Which comes first? The burning or the Bittel? The Ramah states emphatically that the Bittel needs to come last. In other words, you burn what needs to be burnt, and then you say the Bittel. What difference does it make? As far as we're concerned, you know, ein muktam me'uchar b'chametz, both are, you're going to do both. Does it make a difference which one you do first? Says the Vilna Gaon, yes, this once again reflects the opinion of Tosfos. Because according to Tosfos, when you do Bittel, you relinquish the ownership of the chametz. It's not yours anymore. If it's not yours anymore, you have no mitzvah to destroy it. So why are you burning it? According to Tosfos, the mitzvah of Tashbisu is to destroy your chametz. Tashbisu su'omi bateichem. It has to be yours when you destroy it. The last thing you want to do is relinquish ownership of it just before you burn it, because you have actually then deprived yourself of the mitzvah. That is why, according to Tosfos, and reflecting the opinion of Tosfos, first you burn your chametz, and then when all is done, when it's done and dusted, you make your bittel, for everything is ownerless. Because according to Rashi, there would be no reason not to say the bittel first. Firstly, we would hardly say that if you do bittel, you've avoided a mitzvah. According to Rashi, saying the bittel is a mitzvah. It's called tashbisu. And it wouldn't preclude you from burning chametz, which is still yours. So these are the two points where Tosfos left their mark on Minhag Yisrael. Number one, as we said, we explicitly use the word hefker in our text of Bittel, as per Tosfos, and number two, we burn first and say Bittel afterwards in order that the chametz be ours when we're burning it. Just a final word with regards to the way in which we physically get rid of the chametz, which we all do on Erev Pesach, and that is that, as Tosfos referenced, there is a dispute among the rabbis of the Mishnah. How is one meant to get rid of chametz? Is it specifically through burning, as per Rabbi Yehuda, or can it be through any means, as per the Chachamim? So here, once again, there's what you could call halacha and minhag. How so? Because strictly speaking, the Shulchan Aruch rules like the Chachamim, the rabbis, that you can destroy it however you want. They're in the majority. There's other aspects to the machlokas, but not surprisingly, the Shulchan Aruch rules like the Chachamim. You can destroy the chametz however you want, says the Rama, but the minhag is to burn it. Why is the minhag to burn it? Very simply, because according to Rabbi Yehuda, you need to burn it, and the Chachamim never said you can't burn it. They're very easygoing. In other words, they say you can destroy it however you want, including burning. So if you burn it, you fulfilled all opinions. The Chachamim said you can get rid of it however you want, and Rabbi Yehuda says burning specifically, and it's for this reason that the minhag, the universal minhag, really is what's called sreifas chametz. Just one final practical point on the matter of sreifas chametz. One could say characteristically, if that's not taking a liberty, it's from Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach. And that is, says Reb Shlomo Zalman, people, and of course there are other minhagim that relate to the time of sreifas chametz, things that were used in mitzvahs earlier in the year should be used. There's an idea, it's based on the Gemara actually. It was used for one mitzvah, let it be used for another mitzvah. So people keep their Arba Minim and people keep their Hoshanas and so on and so forth, either for sreifas chametz or for baking matzahs. That's a very well-established idea. But sometimes the fire, in order to make sure that things are very Hamish and Labadic with the fire, so people have all sorts of other things that they like to add, like paraffin and the like, and all sorts of inflammable materials, just to make sure that things are really going lemahadrin. Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach was of the opinion that that's not necessarily correct. And the reason is that if we burn the chametz in order to fulfill the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda that the chametz needs to be burned, if you smother it in paraffin beforehand, you have effectively removed it from the category of chametz because it's now inedible. Which means that when you burn it, you're not fulfilling the mitzvah of burning chametz because it's already been destroyed by being rendered absolutely inedible. And that is why Shlomo Zalman was more advocated just using natural wood underneath with a bit of patience. It should it will all work out in the end. So these are some of the classic comments with regards to, again, these institutions, and this really inaugurates Pesach halachically. It begins with Bedikas Chametz, where the bracha, ironically, is Al Biur Chametz. We straight away have the first bittel, and then the second day follow on with the burning and the second bittel. And because the bittel needs to be done after the burning, that's why the burning is all pulled back to late morning. Because, as we mentioned, from the time that you cannot eat or benefit from chametz, you can't do bittel on the chametz. And therefore, because the bittel is the last thing you do, it has to be done before chametz is taken out of your hands, halachically, by being forbidden for consumption and for benefit, which happens at the beginning of the sixth hour. And that's why if you look at your luach, the Sof Zman Sreifas Chometz will be roughly an hour before Chatzos for that reason. It's all time-stamped because of that second bittel, which has to take place before the sixth hour begins, as per Tosfos. Okay, so having discussed a matter of halacha as relates to Pesach, and I hope that we didn't make any what some would consider inflammatory comments, we move now to the Seder itself. And of course, one of the institutions of the Seder is the Arba Kosos. I mean, these are four pillars of the Seder, the four cups. And as we know, the four cups correspond to the four Lashonos of Geula. I see someone just commented here that on Shabbos, yeah, we're going to flush it down the toilet. According to the Chachamim, that's the mitzvah of Tashbisu on Erev Shabbos. And according to Rabbi Huda, you just have no other options. So you actually would not be fulfilling the mitzvah at that time. Back again to the four cups. So they correspond to the four expressions of Otsesi, Vitzalti, Vigalti, Vilakachti, right? The four expressions of Geula, which we will yet talk about. And as such, they actually have the halachic classification of Pirsume Nisa. This is the third in the group of three mitzvahs that are publicizing a miracle. It's the less, generally the lesser identified as such. Of course, we know that Chanukah, right, the menorah is Pirsume Nisa, reading the Megillah is Pirsume Nisa. The four cups are also Pirsume Nisa, and there's certain halachas that go with that as well. So that's the first thing. With regards to that, there is, of course, the fifth expression, Vehevesi, and Vehevesi, bringing to the land of Israel, which, if is reflected by a cup, that will be the cup of Eliyahu, which is poured but not drunk, for indeed the final Geula itself is, we hope, is poured, yet to be drunk. But it should be noted that Pesach does not focus on the land of Israel. And the reason why is because there is another of the Shalosh Regalim which does. And this I don't think is well known. In other words, you have the trilogy, shall we call it, of Pesach, Shavuos, and Sukkos. And they correspond respectively to leaving Mitzrayim, receiving the Torah, and entering the land of Israel. I don't think that people sufficiently appreciate or recognize, I'm not sure that it's commonly known, that Sukkos is primarily about a celebration of entering the land of Israel. That makes it the culmination of the Shalosh Regalim. According to the Abarbanel, it's for this reason that the Arba Minim, which are all about water, certainly Arvei Nachal, it's a celebration of coming from the desert into a place where you have sources of water. And the Rambam goes even further in the Mor Nevuchim, and the Rambam says that the two mitzvahs of Sukkos, namely Sukkah and Arba Minim, correspond to life in the wilderness and life in Eretz Yisrael, respectively. And they're about the transition from A to B. In other words, reflecting the idea that Sukkos is actual huts, so we commemorate the fact that we were in huts and came from there to the land of Israel, where we have Prietz Hadar and Arvei Nachal and so on and so forth. In fact, once again, not only do the mitzvahs reflect this idea that it's gratitude for entering the land of Israel, but also minhagim. Aside from the fact that there is a minhag to decorate the sukkah specifically with fruits of the Shivas Haminim, and some say this is for this reason, but also the minhag of Hoshanus, where we circle on the 7 days of Sukkot, we circle the bima once each day for the first 6 days, and then seven times on Hoshana Rabbah. I mean, that is a parallel, Rabbeinu Bachya says. Parallel to what? To the very first conquest in the land of Israel, the city of Jericho, where they did one hakafah each day, and then seven hakafas on the 7 days. And in fact, the Vilna Gaon goes so far as to say that it's for this reason that on Hoshana Rabbah, all of the Sifrei Torah are taken out of the Aron. For those shuls that have a lot of Sifrei Torah, I remember growing up we had plenty, and they all came out. Now, of course, there's so many shuls per Sifrei Torah, so the ratio is slightly different. If a shul has two Sifrei Torah, that's already considered to be a good result. but if it has 10 or 12, they all come out. On the first day of Sukkot, only one Sefer Torah comes out. Last day of Sukkot, they all come out. Says the Vilna Gaon, why? Because this also corresponds to the conquest of Jericho. How so? Because the Navi describes that on each of the first 6 days, there would be one Kohen sounding the shofar as he went before the Aron. But on day seven, everyone sounded the shofar. And the Vilna Gaon says the Sifrei Torah correspond to those shofars, and I don't think it's well known. it's in his beer to the Shulchan Aruch. And therefore, for the first 6 days, there is one Sefer Torah corresponding to the one shofar, and then on the final day, no holds barred. Everything comes out, and all the Sefer Torah are there. So I mention this, it's important not to lose sight of things. Every central concept of Judaism has its time, has its festivals, and with that in mind, we are aware of Vehevesi, but it's not the focus of Seder night. Vehevesi is really for Sukkot. Moreover, back to the four cups. They are strategically placed, one could say, throughout the Seder, whereby the first cup is Kiddush, the second cup is at the end of the Haggadah, the third cup is for benching, and the fourth cup is Hallel. And the significance of placing them in this way then bestows upon them another element, which is called Kos Shel Bracha. We're familiar on Shabbos and Yom Tov, we start the Suda with Kiddush, and that cup is called Kos Shel Bracha, and has special status and special relationship with that which was said. On Seder night, there are four of those. All four cups are Kos Shel Bracha. They each have something else said over them, which then gives them the status of Kos Shel Bracha. The first, of course, again, is Kiddush. The second is Haggadah. In other words, to say Haggadah over a cup, it gives the makes the cup a Kos Shel Bracha. And benching and Hallel are numbers three and four. So that's just a bit of awareness in terms of the dynamics, shall we say, the halachic dynamics going through the four cups, whether they are Persumei Nissa and Kos Shel Bracha, aside from being expressions of freedom, as the Rambam describes. But I'd like to take a look a little further, a little deeper, into the four cups, and this will come. This discussion is from the Drushas Bina Le'itim of Rabbi Azaria Figo or Feggio from Venice in the 1500s. And the Drushas Bina Le'itim, 75 Drushas, they're classics. Like many of these classic Drushas, time was where you were not taken seriously as a darshan if you didn't know these basic texts. They've since been replaced by others, which are, frankly, probably just because they're shorter. But of course, that's our loss. So, if we want to understand, again, the message of these four cups, so the Bina Le'itim prefaces as follows. When you think about it, he says, there are, when we consider the oppression or damage that can be done, inflicted against the Jewish people by their enemies, it falls into four categories. The first is financial, okay, which can take the form of excessive taxation or discrimination or looting or any of those things. Second is physical, that is to say danger to life and limb. It's another form of damage that can be inflicted. The third is very interesting because the third is an assault on the honor of the Jewish people, on the dignity of the Jewish people. And in its own way, that is as keenly felt, if not more so. It is the agonizing either to be degraded as being worthless, or worse, to be vilified consistently, as we know only too well, It can lead to other forms of oppression, but it itself is already a form of an assault, the covet of the Jewish people. And finally, says Abina Le'itim, spiritual damage. If being influenced by the ways of the nations of the world, whether consciously or unconsciously, whether programmatically or just naturally, the Jewish people can also sustain spiritual damage in that way. A survey of our time in Egypt will yield for us an apprehension that we suffered on all four of these accounts. Whether financially, physically, dignity, and spiritually. Financially, actually, was the first form of assault. And it's important to be sure that we translate correctly, because the very first decree against the Jewish people, as the Pasuk says, Vayasimu alav sarei misim. Now, misim is a word that strikes fear into the heart of anyone who knows what it means. We normally translate sarei misim as taskmasters, but that's not correct. Misim is tax. Taxes, in fact. And what that means is the very first decree against the Jewish people was economic. It was a discriminatory taxation that they should then have to fund the building of those cities, Vayivin, Ari, Miskanos, Lefaro, as Pisa, as Ramses, either do it themselves or pay for it. And therefore, Jewish money was already a target. That's number one. Economic assault. Number two, physical assault. Well, the unspeakable conditions, the harsh slavery itself, where people's life was at risk the whole time, and even those that were that were not killed, they were physically oppressed. Number three, the dignity of the Jewish people. Well, one need not do more than reduce them to a nation of slaves to assault their dignity. They're nothing. A slave is, back in those days, a slave is literally nothing. And finally, the spiritual damage that was caused. Again, whether consciously or unconsciously, we have statements from Chazal and onwards that as much as our time in Egypt, and this is really one of the most important things to understand in its most nuanced form, is whether or not our stay in Egypt was in any way good for us as Jews. Because it's referred to later on in the Chumash as Kor HaBarzel, which is a refining furnace, which means or implies that somehow our stay in Egypt, difficulties included, had a refining effect on us of impurities. On the other hand, the very same sojourn took its toll in terms of our behavior. As the Gemara famously says, the Satan accuses Halalo of the Avodah Zarah, Halalo of the Avodah Zarah, these are idol worshippers, these are idol worshippers. And then the later works talk about the 49 levels of Tumah. It's an amazing fusion of a behavioral descent, but somehow a core consolidation, which was considered necessary and a priority. But there's no question that, again, in terms of our conduct and the things that we picked up, we picked up some bad habits also from Egypt. And these are therefore the four areas that we categorized in the beginning of assault and oppression, all pertained and all existed. It was four for four in Egypt. And this will now give us perhaps a more detailed understanding of what we call the four expressions of Geula. In other words, what we can't do is just see them as four ways of saying the same thing. The four expressions of Geula, or as the Yerushalmi refers to them, the four Geulos, because they really are four aspects of Geula, are nothing less than a fourfold redemption from a fourfold exodus. They are a fourfold rehabilitation from fourfold damage sustained. And let us see how that is the case one by one. The first of the four expressions, Votzesi Eschem Mitachas Sivlos Mitzrayim. Hashem says that Votzesi is the first one. I'll take you out from Sivlos, from the burdens. The word Sivlos is used in conjunction with the taxes. When the Pasuk says that Paro placed Sorei Misim, tax monsters, Leman Anoso Bisivlos Som, in order to oppress them with those burdens. So the Sivlos, as mentioned in the Pasuk, are the economic burdens. And Hashem says, firstly, Votzesi Eschem Mitachas Sivlos Mitzrayim. Jewish money will no longer be Hefker, and their assets will be protected. Number two, Vihitzalti Eschem Me'avodosam. I will save you from actually the work that you need to do, from the avoda, which is taking its toll physically. It's dangerous and it's deleterious, and that's Vihitzalti, from physical assault. And then comes number three. What is a third? Vigo'alti. So what is very interesting about the third term, Vigo'alti, is that the Pasuk says, Vigo'alti Eschem, Bishvotim Gedolim, Uvizroa Netuya, with great judgments and with outstretched arm. Why is that so significant? Because unlike the first two expressions, which said that Hashem would take us out from something and save us from something, Vigo'alti doesn't say what he will redeem us from. Instead, it substitutes by saying how, with what. But we've shifted currency now. Vehotzesi was from the Sivlos. Vehitzalti was from the Avoda. Vigo'alti is not from anything, but it's with Shvatim Gedolim, great judgments, Zroa Netuya. Why is that emphasized? Why is the how emphasized more than the from where in this third term? But the answer is because this is the redemption of the honor of the Jewish people. And it specifically comes through the way that the Exodus was brought about. It was a high-end production. It was great judgments. It was Zroa Netuya, an outstretched arm. All of these refer to the miraculous way in which the final year of the Jewish people was experienced. Those plagues. And what is this doing? It's very important to consider this point. In order to get us out of Egypt, none of the plagues were necessary. One of them would have done. Any type of debilitating condition for Paro, and we'll post him the antidote when we're safely four parsangs away, and that's all you need. But it took on this very, very elaborate form. What is being achieved there? The answer: the redemption of the honor of the Jewish people. This is what took them from being in a state where people thought they were related to them as worthless and insignificant, and here apparently the infinite ruler of the universe considers them to be quite significant and quite important. And with that, the honor of the Jewish people is redeemed. And when they leave biyad rama, yotzim biyad rama. They don't crawl out of Egypt, and they don't roll out of Egypt. They march out of Egypt biyad rama. That is thanks to the geula of their kavod. And then finally, the rehabilitation from the spiritual damage is v'lakachti eschem li la'am. I'll take you to me as a people, which of course is a reference to the process culminating with the giving of the Torah. So to summarize, because I think it is a sweeping vision of the four cups, to understand why you have these four expressions of Geula, why are there four? There were four different dynamics going on, both in the oppression of the Jewish people and the redemption therefrom. Each reflected by a different expression. And with this in mind, we come to the four cups and understand what is represented by each one being in the place that it is. The first cup, as we said, is Kiddush. And we start with what, as far as we're concerned, is the most important, namely our spiritual rehabilitation, which is V'lokachti Asher b'charbanu mikol am, V'ramamanu mikol lashon. It's a celebration of our spiritual rehabilitation. That's what Kiddush is all about. The second cup is Haggadah, and Haggadah is primarily about the rescue from the difficult conditions of slavery. The third cup is the one that accompanies benching. And what is benching if not thanking Hashem for all the bounty that He has given us, all of the resources that He's given us, which is the celebration of the reclaiming of Jewish resources and protection. And finally, the fourth cup is Hallel. And what Hallel really represents is a kind of an exultant state. Any day that you say Hallel is a special day. And when you say Hallel, you feel special on that day. It can either be because it's a Yom Tov or because a miracle happened on that day. But if it's a Hallel day, everyone feels good. And never more than when they're saying Hallel. And this triumphant mood that permeates the Hallel also now reflects the redemption of the kavod of the Jewish people who are exulting in their status as Hashem's chosen people. So these are the comments of the Bina Le'itim, which really, I think, again, give us this vista with regards to this institution of Seder night, which is the four cups. From there, if we make a bit of a start on Maggid, and of course Maggid begins with Halach Ma'anya, and Halach Ma'anya is a magnet for discussion and conversation. It's very unusual. It's in Aramaic, which also needs to be reckoned with. After all, why would it be? And there are some who say that it needs to be in a language that people understand. And there was a time when people understood Aramaic. That was the lingua franca. And so that's why it's in Aramaic. It is true, by the way, that it is imperative, extremely important, that the Seder be understood by everyone there. It's actually more important than it being said in Hebrew, or at least to be said in Hebrew and then translated. One of the Bali HaTosfos who lived in London, there were certain Bali HaTosfos who were in England, and Rabbeinu Yehuda of London is cited by the Ramah in Hilchos Pesach as saying the Haggadah to his family in English. I think if we heard that English nowadays, it would probably need more translation into English for us. But I don't think anyone has perfect English anymore as they used to. But in any case, it is important. However, nowadays that we don't speak Aramaic anymore, so why keep it in Aramaic? It seems to have been petrified in that language, which is now a doubly cumbersome if the whole goal is to facilitate understanding. It is also noteworthy that the Halach Ma'anya at a certain point becomes doubled over. In other words, we start by saying this is the bread of affliction, this is the matzah, but then we say Kol Dichvin Yesev Yechel. Whoever is hungry, let them come and eat. Kol Ditzrich Yesev Yechel. Whoever is in need, let them come and do Pesach with us. I mean, it's a kind of a double-barreled invitation. And then the final sentence is also dual. Hashata hocha l'shana ba ba'arad Yisrael, this year here, next year in Israel. Hashata adi l'shana ba b'nei chorin, this year slaves, next year free. So the second and third sentences really are double-barreled, as we said. So what's this all about? One of the classic Haggadahs from the last couple of centuries is known as the Malbim Haggadah. There is some discussion as to whether the Malbim himself authored it. Either he did or someone else authored it in the style of the Malbim as a tribute, really, to the importance of the Malbim's approach and how it's necessary for the Haggadah. Either way, some people have very strong opinions one way or the other. I don't. So let's find out what the Malbim Haggadah says. This is the introduction to the Seder as it was appended during the time of our first exile, which was in Bavel. And that's why it's in Aramaic, because it dates back, it was an addition from the time of the Babylonian exile. But what's interesting is, when we came back to the land of Israel, says the Malbim Haggadah, so we still kept it on. because people still continued, the vernacular was still Aramaic. In the times of the second Beis HaMikdash, more people spoke Aramaic than spoke Hebrew, and people understood Aramaic better than they spoke Hebrew. For which reason, as we know, during laning, when the Torah was read, they would actually read Unkelus's translation together with the laning for the benefit of people who otherwise wouldn't understand. Which means that all the sentiments of Halach Ma'anya continue to be said in Aramaic, even when we came back to the land of Israel. But actually, it's for this reason, says the Malbim Haggadah, that everything is phrased in a dual way. Because first you have the way that it was said in Babel, in Babylonian exile, when it was originally instituted, and then you have the way that it became transmuted into life in Israel during the Second Commonwealth. And we now remember both. And therefore, after we say Halach Ma'anya, so what do we say? Kol dichvin yeseh v'yechal. Whoever's hungry, let them come and eat. That's all you can say in Bavel. You can't say whoever needs, let them partake of the Pesach with us. You don't have a Pesach in Bavel. So the Pesach invitation for Bavel is whoever's hungry, let them come and eat, which is what we say nowadays. But then the second half of that sentence is how it then changed when they came into Israel, because now they do have a Korban Pesach. And now they say, Kol Ditzrich Yeseh V'Yifsach. Whoever needs, let him come and do Pesach with us. The actual Pesach during the second Beis HaMikdash. And finally, says the Malbim Haggadah, how do we conclude? The first part of that last sentence says, this year here, next year in Israel. That's what they said when they were in Bavel, because they weren't in Israel. But then the second half of the sentence says, this year slaves, next year free. That was said by those who came back. They're in Eretz Yisrael, so they're not saying this year here, next year in Israel. But they weren't free. As we know, throughout the entirety, pretty much, to a greater or lesser degree, from the beginning of the Second Commonwealth, always under the control and under the aegis and under the auspices and jurisdiction of foreign governments, whether it's Persia to begin with, which is then taken over by Greece. And after you have that, those few years where there was some type of independence through the Hashmonaim, Rome, it's not long before they come and take over. So as much as we were in the land of Israel, hard to say that we were completely free. And there's a lot to ponder in terms of where we are nowadays in terms of our situation. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his commentary on the Haggadah, he makes a point with regards to Halach Ma'anya, which for him really opens up the Seder. Because if it was originally said when people were in Golos, so then it really begs the question as to how much have things improved since when we were in Egypt. Here we are celebrating having, leaving Egypt, but you're back in Golos. But the truth is, says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, it's not the same. Because for those who are determined enough, wherever they are, they can make it to the land of Israel, which was not true when we were in the original Egyptian exile. And number two, the Jewish people have the capacity to bring the Golos to an end, whatever they want. Whether they choose to do that or not is another question. But again, unlike the Golos in Mitzrayim, which had a set term, which was largely non-negotiable. And that's why we say this year here, next year Israel, this year slaves, next year free, which means we have the capacity to move to the land of Israel. We have the capacity to bring about our freedom. That's as much as we're in Golos, but it's a different quality of Golos. It is much more dealable with, as far as we're concerned, and thus we celebrate Yetzias Mitzrayim, where none of this was possible. Let's just maybe spend the last few moments on Manishtana, of course, where we start Maggid at the beginning. There's only so much we can do in an hour. We dare not risk being those for whom the students came in and said the time for the morning Shema has arrived. So we'll content ourselves with just these final few moments. The order of the questions of Manishtana is very interesting. Because, and Rav Kook raises this question in his commentary, Olas Re'iyah, his Perush on the Haggadah, because we start, where, as we know, with Chametz and Matzah, and then and Shar Yerokos, and then we talk about Matbilin Shnei Pa'amim, and then Ben Yoshvim Ben Mesubim, sitting and reclining. In terms of what the child will have witnessed, he will have seen more reclining and also one of the dippings. It's very interesting that questions 3 and 4 on the list are things that he's already seen, whereas questions 1 and 2, he hasn't seen them. He may know that they're coming, in which case he's actually quite smart. But the questions don't seem to follow an experiential chronological time frame. Says Rav Kook, what he says is going to be, it's going to sound like a chiddush, but actually, as we'll go back, we'll see it's really consolidated by earlier sources. And Rav Kook suggests that, remember, we have 4 sons, and 3 of them ask their questions after a fashion, whether it's their elaborate questions or very just to the point questions. And then you have this 4th son who just doesn't know how to ask. So what do? Says Rav Kook, it appears that the Manishtana is a set of questions for him. If he doesn't know how to ask, so we'll give him questions to ask. It's very interesting. I mean, it frames the Manishtana, the 4 questions of Manishtana, as to be in the province of the Ein Yode Lishol. He doesn't know to ask, so we give him to ask. And what's interesting is, Rashi, in what's called the commentary of Rashi on the Pesach Haggadah. So, what do we say about this Ein Yode Lishol son, the son who doesn't know how to ask? At Pesachlo, open for him, right? Open for him. What does that mean, open for him? So I think we understand, listen, he's not saying anything, you're not saying anything, if no one says anything, nothing's going to happen. So it would be nice if he asked, but Tachlis, he's not asking, so just get on with it. At Pesachlo, start the proceedings. But Rashi says no. Rashi says, the child that doesn't know how to ask, open him. Says Rashi, Kedesha Yishal, do something that he should ask. Give him an opening to ask, because he's not spontaneously seizing upon anything. And the truth is, this seems to be the message from the Mishnah. Because the Mishnah, as we know, the halachas of Seder are in the final perek of Psachim, and it says they pour the 2nd cup. Vekan haben shoel, and here the son asks. Vim ein bo das, if he doesn't have a knowledge to ask, aviv melamdo, his father teaches him. Manishtana. So, in other words, the simple reading of the Mishnah seems to be that manishtana is what you teach a child who doesn't otherwise know how to ask. What we call the Eino Yodea Lishol, says Rav Kook, and that explains why the questions are in the order that they are, because they're in increasing order of unusualness. And as we're looking to give him a hook or something, and therefore we start with a mild change. Chametz to matzah, I mean, there's still bread, and you know, people do have matzah. From maror to other yerokos, just to maror, that's already a more of a pronounced change. All we're looking for him is a glimmer in his eyes, which says, "Oh yeah, I don't know, what is that?" And then we have an opening. And if that doesn't go, then in addition to the foods we're eating, there's additional dippings, and then people are reclining. In other words, it's expanding outwards in terms of things that are increasingly, hopefully, likely to get his attention. But the moral of the story is no meaningful message will be imparted if the child doesn't ask. Because if you just give him information, you're talking to someone who's closed. A person who's opened up through questions. And I think that's a worthwhile thing to be conscious of, even beyond Seder night, for children and for everyone. I think I do think about this often, being involved in teaching and in various places. And people ask sometimes, it's kind of a popular topic, has there been Yeridas Hadoros among the students? Have people become dumber, and has the level gone down? Do you find that the things that you used to teach you can't teach anymore? And I've thought about it many times, and in my personal experience, the main difference between students as they used to be and students as they are now is not what they're intellectually capable of handling as an idea, but how prone are they to be bothered by something which seems to be a difficulty or an anomaly, or does it wash over them? Because, in other words, I think it's fair to say, if there is a Yiras HaDoros in students, it's not that we've gone from being wise to being simple. We've gone from being wise to Eino Yodea Lishol. Because if nothing bothers you enough to ask, there's no point giving the answer. As Reb Shlomo Fischer Zatzal used to say, there can be no Yesh Lomar if there was never an In Tomar. In other words, if nothing's opened up, so then nothing, there's no resolution if there's no agitation. So these, I think, certainly are things to... It's a message from the Seder that rings true for every day of the year. But our discussion for this evening has reached a resting place. Mitzvah Hashem will pick up again next week, continue our deliberations on Pesach and Haggadah Shel Pesach. All the very best and have a wonderful week.